I just want to say it's a pleasure to be here with you this morning, and it's great to see so much interest in what's going on in Arizona, because I think it's very important in terms of what we're going to see going on in other states. I also want to commend the piece that the Center has put together. It's an excellent piece. It gives you the facts down and dirty about Arizona. It also gives the questions that you need to be asking about your own state. It's a very good piece. I'd like to kind of put this in context for us and give you at least my take on how it is that we got where we are today. Just to begin the thinking, you need to understand that really the groundwork began to be laid for 1070 in Arizona about 15 years ago when initiatives were announced by the administration to begin to militarize the border. And that really changed the complexion of the way that the states along the border, and particularly Arizona, look at undocumented people and indeed look at brown-skinned people. You also need to know that more people die in the Tucson sector than the rest of the border combined. More people are arrested and deported from the Tucson sector than the rest of the border combined. And the Tucson sector is not all of Arizona. It's only about two-thirds of the state. The other unfortunate piece of this puzzle is the interplay with the drug war that's going on in Mexico. More drugs are seized in the Tucson corridor up through the Altar Valley than any other sector along the border. And that really makes dealing with issues of migration and treatment of migrants very difficult. Make no mistake, in my view, we're not talking only about 1070 and sort of reactionary legislation. What we're dealing with in Arizona is nothing short of an all-out race war. And I think it's really important that we understand that. You know, Lucas is going to talk about the legal challenges, and certainly they're very important. And it's great that we have our best and brightest fighters in the ring slugging that out. But for all intents and purposes, 1070 has been in effect in Arizona for the last couple of years. And what do I mean by that? Well, I mean if you're Mexicano, you're Chicano, Mexican-American, Latino, whatever label you assigned yourself, you know, it's very likely that you'd be stopped by the police for having a tail light out or a license plate light out or not fully stopping at a stop sign. And the questions that will be asked is for your driver's license, proof of insurance, and your immigration document. And what we see is then that opens the door for search of the vehicle, search of the person, all sorts of other actions, police actions, that have criminal law implications, but for the police officer asking for documents, the door wouldn't be able to be opened. We also see during the pre-legislative vote on 1070, all of the county sheriffs weighed in on what they thought about it. And with the exception of Arpaio in Maricopa County and sort of a guy in the next door county who was a wannabe Arpaio, all the other sheriffs in the county said, well, we don't think that local law enforcement ought to enforce immigration laws. But my county's sheriff went on to say, and he's sort of a moderate Democrat who's been in office for 20 years or so, good Catholic guy, he went on to say, and I think that because we already call the Border Patrol when we stop somebody and we think they're here illegally. And we get more people removed than old Joe up the road. And, you know, I think that that's very telling, because what he's saying is, don't pass the law because we do it anyway. I think it's important that we understand that 1070 is a political predicate to comprehensive immigration reform. I was an immigration lawyer before the last amnesty, and what we saw in the years leading up to that, certainly the late 70s and early 80s, was a tremendous push to get people to leave, either to scare people, to terrorize communities so they would leave on their own, or you know, Border Patrol raids at soccer games on Sunday afternoon, or Border Patrol waiting outside the church after Mass. And it's really no different. And so I think that we have to understand that that's the climate that gives birth to 1070. It's not just federal inaction. I think it's something else. It is a recognition, and particularly a recognition of those who fear regularization, that regularization is inevitable. It's just a matter of time. Sometimes we think of regularization as a radical remedy, but it's really not. It is as much a part of American immigration law as, you know, our family-based scheme and our employment-based scheme. The first time there was a regularization was in 1924. The sort of political thinking then was, well, let's sign them all up. We did it again in 48. That was a thank you for working in the war effort. We did it again in 72. That was sort of a manifestation of coming together of the Chicano movement, the anti-war movement, the women's movement, the black movement. And we did it again in 86. That's actually the shortest period, the 14-year period between 72 and 86 is the shortest period. And that's the first time that we sort of turned a policy corner and said, okay, but you can't work anymore after 86. But the point being is about every 24 years, with the exception of the 72 to 86 period, we say sign them all up, because the statutory scheme that we have in place simply can't accommodate the numbers of people that enter our country. And so I think it's important to understand that we're again, once again, in this period. And it is comforting in that we know that regularization is inevitable. History tells us it's inevitable. It is very difficult in that is a period when all of us must engage in not just resistance in the race war, but exposure of what it is and what it means. This environment opens the door, at least in Arizona, and I'm sure in other states there are similar provisions, for sort of a lawful way to determine status and therefore lodge other criminal charges. And let me just give you a couple of examples in Arizona. And as I say, I'm sure these examples are prevalent in other states. In Arizona, if the state can show that you entered without inspection or overstayed a lawful admission, you're not eligible for bail during your processing of your criminal case. And that's a really big deal, because it makes it very difficult to defend a case when someone has to stay in custody. Also, the right to bail is a fundamental constitutional protection, and only in the most serious and egregious circumstances are people denied bail. It's used as a sentence enhancer in Arizona. In other words, there are statutory mitigators and enhancers, and being out of status or being pop culture illegal alien is a basis to increase your sentence for a crime that has nothing to do with status. If you are driving a car and are stopped and the allegation is lodged that you have no status because perhaps you don't have an Arizona driver's license, even though you may have a valid Mexican driver's license, it's required that your car is towed and impounded and held for 30 days. And so for poor people, usually what happens is people can't redeem their car because that's an exorbitant cost. And finally, there is in Arizona, you may have heard during the last session, the legislature passed a bill that said everybody can carry concealed weapons without a permit, except two groups of people who are mentally ill and people who are undocumented. And so the mere fact that you can't produce to the police officer who encounters you either on the street or in your car in your home proof of lawful presence gives the officer the ability to search and perhaps lodge that charge if a weapon is found in your house or in your presence. One thing that I think is very, very important that we just rail against at every opportunity is this pop culture definition of status. You know, it's obviously extra statutorial. And it ignores completely, you know, the scheme that sets up the immigration court proceeding. The allegations are large. You defend against them. If you lose, then you make application for relief. And in the pop culture sense, an officer can simply say, you know, you appear to be, there's probable cause to believe that you're an illegal alien, and so it gives me the right to ask questions and do all these other things. We've got to resist that at all costs and in every forum. You know, we're involved in Arizona with a campaign that is not just aimed at 1070, but it's a campaign that strategy in essence is to confront the race war and resist the racist categorization of undocumented people. It's my dear friend Congressman Grijalva, the day after the governor signed 1070, called for a boycott of the state, and he's taken a lot of flack for it. And so our campaign is a boycott bicot, and we've asked businesses to reject racism, reject 1070, but to reject racism. And so sort of the context of the campaign is to lay bare that this is not a question of just who's with us and who shouldn't be with us, and should law enforcement, local law enforcement, ask people for documents. It's all about race. And we're calling on the community to actually post signs in businesses and say they reject racism. We're calling on the community to support businesses that do that. And that's sort of what's happening on the ground in Arizona. I think the legal work that Lucas is doing is very, very important, because we've got to push back on that front. But more importantly, we have to push back in the community dialogue about race. And I think that really is the essence of 1070. Thank you.